Republican tax plan will touch every part of American life if it passes. And today we focus on higher education. Here's a PhD student in Michigan talking to Fox 47.
We make about $15,000 a year, and that's hard to get by when you're not supporting people. We have international students, we have parents, we have people supporting families and spouses. It's just not acceptable.
Plus, Francisca Lino is an immigrant in Chicago facing deportation. She's now taking sanctuary at a local church while she and her lawyer, Chris Bergen, are engaged in a lawsuit against the federal government.
I brought a letter to the ICE office, and we said she's not hiding. Here's where she is. She's here with her faith community.
And 50 years ago, Frances Brenton traveled alone in a canoe from Chicago to Senegal, more than 4,000 miles away. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. If you've been tuning into the news lately, odds are you've been hearing a lot about taxes and how you'll be left paying more or less come tax time. Senate Republicans narrowly passed their version of a major tax overhaul in the early hours of Saturday morning. The U.S. House of Representatives, of course, passed its own tax plan in November. In the days ahead, members of Congress will meet and try to negotiate a compromise with President Donald Trump, urging them to reconcile differences before a self-imposed goal of December 22nd. University officials and student groups are among those paying close attention to these efforts. U of I Associate Professor Jennifer Delaney, a higher ed finance expert, will join us from our Urbana studios in just a few minutes. We'll also hear from Andrew Craigbaum, a federal policy reporter for Inside Higher Ed. But first, on the line now from Chicago is M. Hall. She's a PhD student at UIC, where she studies urban planning. M., welcome to the 21st.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be here.
So, Em, you're an urban planning PhD student focusing on transportation. You have 3 years left until wrapping up your program. I'm wondering, as you learn more and more about both the House and the Senate tax plans, which could significantly alter deductions and tuition waivers for you and other graduates, how are you feeling?
A little worried, more than a little worried. It's a huge concern, and especially as someone who was out in the workforce for more than a decade in a different field, you know, having just chosen to return full time to school in a PhD program and make a career pivot. I'm definitely concerned and sort of, you know, questioning my choices and my timing in some ways as well.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. So you just mentioned you were in the workforce, you had a full time job running a nonprofit. And I don't think this is wrong to say, you took a chance, right, going back to school. Do you think you would have made the same choice going back if, you know, some of the points that are in the House and Senate plans were in place then?
I can't say 100%, but I think it would have been a great deterrent and definitely a huge factor in the calculations of, as you said, a risk of going back to school and making a big change like this. So, you know, I'd look at probably $4,000 to $5,000 more a year in taxes. It's a four-year program here. Some students take five. Looking at that additional $20,000 to $25,000 in taxes, all for something that is really a pursuit of knowledge for me and a desire to make change, that's a huge trade-off to weigh. And I can't say that I would make the same decision were I applying for this program a year later than I had.
So what specifically about this tax plan are you worried about when it comes to you and your education and the finances of it?
Absolutely. I am a recipient of a tuition waiver as part of my program here at the university, and my department additionally has a tuition differential, which for this program is $2,500 a semester. So there's the tuition you see, there's the tuition differential, and that combined would give me a significant income, quote unquote, on paper that would be taxable. And it's just not what I'm seeing in my paycheck every month. I'm a teaching assistant and also a research assistant. And that is a wonderful thing, both from an academic standpoint and also from an ability to make a living as a graduate student, a living wage that I can get by on. But were that, tax to come into place would make it very hard to justify leaving a full-time job and a great career to come back to school. The risk is so much higher, and I don't know that I could make those calculations and make that work.
So there are a lot of people out there who maybe have made a similar decision, take a risk, go back to school, change your life direction. What do you hope to do with an urban planning PhD?
And I'm thinking this more and more, especially in our current environment, I would like to run for office eventually. I think someone with an urban planning background would have a lot to contribute to the conversation, especially in execution of city management and the creation of public policy.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
That's PhD student M. Hall, who studies urban planning at the University of Illinois, Chicago. We're talking tax reform here on the 21st, learning a little bit more about what it could mean for students and colleges across the state. We heard from one grad student a moment ago, and we'll now hear from a couple of experts who've been following all the twists and turns of the tax reform saga from the beginning. Jennifer Delaney is an associate professor of higher education at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. She joins us from our Urbana studios. I'd also like to welcome Inside Higher Ed federal policy reporter Andrew Craigbaum to the conversation. He's on the line from his newsroom in Washington, D.C. Jennifer, Andrew, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So, Jennifer, I'd like to start by breaking down some of the key differences between the House tax plan and the one recently passed by the Senate. One of the main ones is that the House plan wants to tax tuition waivers that graduate students receive. We just heard from one such student a moment ago. They get these waivers for working as teaching or research assistants. That's not in the Senate plan, but we don't really know what's going to happen as the two chambers try to reach a compromise. Jennifer, if tuition waivers are taxed, how would that affect college affordability, accessibility for grad students?
So thank you for having me on, and thank you for addressing this important issue. Taxing of tuition waivers for graduate students will make college much less affordable for graduate students. And as we just heard from the graduate student at UIC, graduate students are doing really important work in terms of advancing knowledge for us as a nation and also potentially in contributing in public service by running for office. Currently, tuition waivers are not taxed. As you mentioned, this is in the House bill, but not the Senate bill. Graduate students do receive stipends for their work, either as teaching or research assistants, but they tend not to be very high wages. So part of the compensation that they receive is receiving a tuition waiver where they don't have to pay tuition for their studies. For students that, especially that attend private institutions where tuition is very high, or for out-of-state students at public institutions, this could significantly make it look on paper that they're receiving a lot more income than they actually do. And because those wages aren't very high, it's not clear that all graduate students will actually have the resources to be able to pay the tax bill. There was another U of I PhD student actually quoted in the Inside Higher Education newspaper that said it's like taxing a coupon, that you receive this waiver for school with tuition and being taxed on that coupon is really challenging for students to figure out financially how they're able to stay in school or even to make the decision to go to school.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. I had not heard that before. Speaking of Inside Higher Ed, Andrew, I wanted to ask you, what are some of the other noticeable differences between the House and Senate plans?
Sure. Well, there's several provisions in the House plan affecting not just graduate students, but a lot of tax benefits for students and student borrowers. And I think a lot of the higher ed community may have been a little relieved when those were left out of the Senate tax plan, but there's still a lot of really concerning provisions in the Senate bill that was just passed for colleges and universities, especially affecting institutional finance. You've got a tax on private college endowments included. There's a change to deductions for state and local taxes that a lot of college groups say could hurt state budgets that support public universities. And then there's changes to tax-exempt bonds as well, or elimination of tax-exempt bonds in both bills that colleges and universities use for building facilities and other purposes.
Well, let's talk about the student loan interest deduction then. I mean, how does that work exactly?
Sure. So student borrowers every year they pay off their student loans, but they're also paying off interest on those. They also accrue interest on those loans. The current tax structure allows them to deduct that interest, and if that's eliminated in the final tax bill, again, that's in the House bill but not the Senate bill. If that provision is included, that would mean borrowers could be paying several hundred dollars more per year, depending on their income level and the amount of student loan debt they hold.
Okay, so if I have, I'm paying interest on my loans, then, I get a tax break on that. Now that might go away. Jennifer, I wonder then, we've heard about some of the differences. Is there a consensus among higher education leaders about which of the House or the Senate version would affect colleges and universities more?
So there are fewer provisions in the Senate bill, and some of the more concerning provisions are in the House bill, the tax and graduate student tuition waivers, the student loan interest deduction. So in general, the Senate version of the bill is preferred, there's less in it. And some of the most concerning elements aren't in that one. But both bills have things that are of great concern to students, to families, to folks that were students and are dealing with student loan debt, and also to institutions.
Well, Jennifer, we touched on some of the differences. Let's talk a little bit about the commonalities now. With both the House and Senate tax plans are trying to tax the income of college endowments, targeting the largest endowments at private institutions. Has that ever been done before?
It has not for education institutions. There is some regulation out there from the IRS where there is some urging of spending for private foundations. A key difference between that and what's proposed for universities is, although there is some endowment spending required of foundations, it's for foundation purposes. The way that the provisions would work in either the House or Senate plans, and there are some differences between the two, but it would be a tax. So instead of encouraging universities to spend more of their endowment on their missions and their educational purposes, that money would go into federal coffers. So that's really different than what's been done in the past vis-a-vis other sort of charities and private foundations.
And so, I mean, that's not to say public universities would not be affected by this either. Jennifer, I wonder how would, public schools like the University of Illinois be affected by some of the changes in either of the plans?
Right. So right now in both the House and Senate plans, they would only impact private institutions and private institutions with the largest endowments. So the House version has a threshold of $250,000 per full-time equivalent student. The Senate version has a threshold of $500,000 per full-time equivalent student in endowment value. But you asked the question about what this might mean for the University of Illinois. I think there's a lot of fear in the higher education community that this is sort of having, the camel's nose under the tent, that once you go after private endowments, that public endowments may be sort of the next target. U of I has the 34th largest endowment in the nation, according to the National Association of College
Wow.
and University Business Officers. So in fiscal year 2017, if we add up what the U of I Foundation and the university itself holds in endowments, it's $2.45 billion. And we also just launched a very large capital campaign, which, not all that money will go to the endowment, but likely our endowment will grow over time. So if this is ever in the future expanded into public institutions, it's likely going to impact institutions like the University of Illinois.
Okay, so we've heard now about tuition waivers, taxing endowment income, getting rid of the student loan interest deductions, lots of moving parts here. Andrew, I want to go back to you now. I wonder if some of these bigger changes are, in fact, signed into law. What does this mean for college accessibility?
Well, the college university groups are warning that this could have pretty negative effects, especially the provisions affecting student tax benefits in the House bill. But even if those aren't included in the final bill, They're warning about some of the changes in the Senate version of tax reform that could negatively impact university budgets and then have secondary impacts that would possibly include higher tuition for students. We talked about the endowment issue, but capping state and local tax deductions, which is part of both bills, it could mean, it will mean higher tax bills for taxpayers in many states, and that could place that could mean more pressure on state lawmakers to make cuts elsewhere. Typically, when state lawmakers cut spending, higher ed is one of the first places they look. And when college and universities get less support from their states, often what happens is tuition goes up.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jennifer, we've only got about 30 seconds left. There's one little provision that we haven't talked about, merchandising, right? I understand that there is a proposal to originally the Senate plan was going to tax income from licensing names and logos for universities.
Right. So this is only in the Senate bill, so we don't know how it'll come out in conference. But right now, any royalties from naming or logos are not taxed. So if you buy, an orange Black Eye T-shirt to support the football team here, all of those licensing revenues are captured by the university. If the provision passes, those revenues would be taxed, resulting in a lower income flow to institutions.
Okay, that's U of I Associate Professor Jennifer Delaney and Inside Higher Ed Federal Policy Reporter Andrew Craigbaum. Thank you so much for joining us. You are listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Francisco Lina is still in Chicago, taking sanctuary in a church on the city's west side. Her case has received national attention in recent months. Lina's lived in the United States for the past two decades. She's married to a U.S. citizen. Together, they have six children. But she entered the U.S. illegally in 1999, and when she applied for a green card 6 years later, she was arrested but allowed to return home. Earlier this year, federal immigration officials ordered her deported to Mexico. That's when she sought to refuge in the Adalberto United Methodist Church in Chicago. Last month, her lawyers filed a civil rights lawsuit against the government. They argue in the suit that she was deported in 1999 without due process. All of this comes as cities like Chicago push back against tougher federal enforcement of immigration policies under the administration of President Donald Trump. We'll talk in a few minutes about the legal stakes in this sort of case and what might happen next. But first, Reverend Walter Coleman is the pastor at Francisco Lina's church. He's currently housing Francisca in sanctuary. Reverend Coleman, thank you for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
Reverend, I'm wondering, you've known Francisca for some time. Your church is now providing her sanctuary, and many people might remember you previously provided sanctuary for other immigrants, including Elvira Arellano. Can you give us a sense of Francisca's living situation? How does she spend her days?
Well, she's in a good kind of collective situation. One of the pastors is there, and she shares two apartments above the church in the same building. So she stays in an apartment with the pastor. And then actually Elvira Arellano is now back in the country. That's a story in itself. But she's on the third floor with her husband and two children. So they're there and they're pretty active. Things are going on in the church every day, one kind or another. A lot of people who face the same situation come in to pray with her and talk with her and get advice and so forth. So she stays pretty active. And then her family, unfortunately, it was a two two-income family. She was working before, so that her husband is working extra time where they live, and her kids are going to school. So they're together on the weekends and from time to time during the week. But she's it's not as good a situation as she would like in terms of being all together with her family. But at least she's with them a few times a week.
Yeah, well, so that's what I was going to be my next question. Her family is still in Bolingbrook. She can't leave then, I guess, to go see her. They have to come visit her? Is that how that works?
Yeah, exactly. No, she never leaves the church. I was trying to explain to somebody, this is we live in a sanctuary city, but we don't live in a city that bars or keeps ICE or Homeland Security from coming in and arresting somebody. So if she left the church, it would be very likely to be arrested.
Well, you also mentioned that her husband is working extra hours. This was a two-income family.
Right.
We said they have children. How have they been affected by this otherwise?
Well, it's tough, you know. Without going too much into the personal problems, there are a lot of we have a lot of families like this over the years, and we've had two cases of attempted suicide from the kids. It's a lot of tension and pressure on the kids. You know, they don't know really from day to day what's going to happen, you know, to their mother or what would happen to them. You know, some of the older girls who are now 15 and 16 say that if she's deported, then some of them will go back to Mexico with her because it's a very dangerous place and they don't want her to be alone. So it's tough, and they're trying to stay there. Francisca is a very good mother and keeps their spirits up, monitors what they do in school and other activities, and tries to keep them on the case. And when she was first arrested, they thought that they were actually going in for an interview in which she was going to get a green card because her husband had applied for her. When they had a celebration all planned, and she was actually at that time had just come out of the hospital. She just had twins, and the twins were still in the hospital. They were preemies. When she was arrested, actually, her husband had a heart attack within an hour of that arrest. So, yeah, you know, it has a big effect on everybody. And obviously, you know, it has a big effect on their income and so forth. You know, they really felt that they were going to be here for the duration, and so they made commitments to mortgages and things like that, which depended on her income.
So how did we get to this point? How did Francisca Lino come to live in the Chicago area?
Well, she fell in love when she came. I think when people talk about how people why people from Mexico, especially in those days, came across the border, if you look back to NAFTA that went into effect in the 90s, at that time you had a big agribusiness really flooded Mexico with very cheap corn and rice, and that destroyed most of the small farmers and even some of the larger ones. In fact, over 5 million agricultural workers were put out of work. And ironically, that's the same number that they estimate came across the border. So it's not exactly that they came here for the American dream. In a way, they came here because of what the American nightmare did to their country. But they came here, you know, to work and to be able to survive, and in many cases to send money back home. And then Francisca, like other people, when she met Mr. Lino, they fell in love and got married and had kids and have been living a pretty normal life, although she joined Familia Latina Unida quite a while ago, 2003, and has been pretty active, and she's testified in Congress and in the city council and the state legislature and so forth like that, and marched a lot of times and tried to help other families as well. So she's pretty experienced at this, and we think a very good spokesperson.
So can you talk about, I imagine she talked with you as she made her decision to seek refuge in the church. What was the initial thought process for St. Francisca like when she received this deportation order? You know, what led her to seek sanctuary?
Well, you know, we've gone through a lot of legal processes with her, which is why she was able to stay here for a long time. You know, we had We had a private bill for her from Congressman Gutierrez and later one from Senator Burris. And when they introduced a private bill, that a private bill would actually have the Congress confer citizenship on someone. When they introduced a private bill, that puts an automatic stay on the deportation. So she'd gone through that process for a while. And then finally, when President Obama set what he called prosecutorial discretion, that is, he set priorities so that somebody like Francisca, who has no legal violations of any kind and is working and stable and has U.S. citizen children, they became a very low priority, and she just had to check in every year with ICE, which she did regularly and like she was supposed to. So, you know, it wasn't until the spring, and under Trump's new policy, there are no priorities. If you ever came across the border without authorization, even if it was 25 years ago, then they're going to try to deport you. So mm-hmm. they told her at their last check-in that she would have to be out of the country and by and come down to the office and bring her ticket to Mexico in July. So instead of doing that, she determined she would go into sanctuary. You know, in terms of the process that people go through, I think you have it on your mind for years and you think about what would happen and what you would do and how you would react. And I think in some ways the family felt this is a very difficult situation and sanctuary is kind of a last desperate effort. Though I think we have a good legal case now, but at that time we weren't sure what we could do legally. And I think in the few days before she went to sanctuary, she herself made the decision and convinced the family to support her. Mm-hmm. She basically said, look, I'm just not going to have my whole life here treated like it was garbage. I'm not going to be disrespected that way and have the life that I've worked so hard to build just totally disrespected. And I'm not going to just allow them to put me and my family in a very dangerous situation in Mexico.
You mentioned ICE a moment ago, and I should add we reached out to federal immigration officials in Chicago. We got a statement. They say they don't comment on pending litigation. They also said, quote, current ICE policy directs agency personnel to avoid conducting enforcement activities at sensitive locations unless they have mm-hmm. prior approval from an appropriate supervisory official or in the event of exigent circumstances. The locations specified in the guidance include schools, places of worship, and hospitals. Reverend, I'm wondering, have there been any contacts with immigration officials since she initially came to your church?
No, not at the church, since she's been there. We haven't had any contact or communication with them. We filed suit, and we, you know, our attorneys talk with ICE agents on a regular basis on a number of different cases, and including this one. They were informed of the lawsuit, and we'll see how that takes place. I think when she was stopped originally, that was right after the 1996 law had been passed and went into effect, and they were very sloppy in the way that they implemented it, so that she was never really she didn't sign anything. She was given no explanation that she wasn't just being turned back. She was actually being given what's called an expedited deportation, which means that she had a deportation on her record, which is why they took the action to arrest her and to try to deport her on the original expedited deportation order. I just think it's probably hard for us to understand with all the legal discussion that's gone on in the years, but especially in those days, people routinely went to try to cross the border. If that didn't work the first time, then they tried it the next time. Mm-hmm. Some people, you know, went through the desert and everything, but most people just went, through the turnstile and tried to get in. So it was just that you go across to work and try to send money back home. It was part of the culture at that time.
All right. Well, that's Reverend Walter Coleman of Adalberto United Methodist Church in Chicago. He's currently housing Francisca Lino in sanctuary. Thank you, Reverend, for your time.
Yes, sir.
We are now joined by Dean Vikram Amar of the University of Illinois College of Law to give us more of a sense of the legal issues surrounding this case. Dean Amar, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
So what options does someone have under the law when they're currently in the country illegally?
Well, I'm not actually an immigration law specialist, and that's a very large question. But I understand that in this case, the lawsuit that her lawyers have filed focus on that original 1999 arrest at the border when she was arrested for illegally trying to enter the country. And that really was the beginning of all her subsequent legal troubles, because after she came to the United States later and then tried to get a green card in 2005, it was her failure to disclose the 1999 arrest that led to her being charged with a crime in 2005, that is, not being fully forthcoming in the green card process. So now what her lawyers have done is they've filed a case that alleges that that original 1999 arrest was flawed because there wasn't adequate due process given to her under the Fifth Amendment. She may not have been informed of what was going on in her native language, and therefore that procedure might not have been fair. That's a long time ago, and I think there are some disputed facts probably that the government will contest. They may remember things differently than she does. And I'm not sure how much due process the Supreme Court has required for arrests at the border, but that's what she is pursuing right now. All of that is somewhat separate from the larger question that you adverted to earlier in your lead-in about the grassroots pushback among cities and states around the country, including churches, but mostly city and state governments, to become so-called sanctuary jurisdictions, to refrain from providing any assistance to the federal government as it tries to enforce its immigration laws.
Yeah, well, what does that mean in this context? So we say that Mrs. Leno is taking sanctuary in a church while living in a sanctuary city. What does that mean, sanctuary city, in this context?
Well, in general, a sanctuary city or a sanctuary state is a jurisdiction that has decided under its own laws and policies that it does not want to provide aid or assistance to federal immigration authorities. That aid or assistance could take the form of detaining persons for some period of time while the federal government comes down to arrest them under the federal law. If you have individuals who are already in state or county jail, sometimes the feds will ask locals to hold on to the person, and a lot of these sanctuary jurisdictions say, no, we don't want to do that. It also may involve the provision of information. The feds also, in various ways, ask states and localities to provide information about individuals who may or may not be in the state or city unlawfully, and a lot of sanctuary jurisdictions don't want to provide that information. So in this case, the fact that she's in a sanctuary jurisdiction or a sanctuary city of Chicago, since Chicago has taken those steps, is not that relevant, because the city is not really doing anything to either prevent the federal government from arresting her or to facilitate the federal government from arresting her. Her sanctuary is of a different kind, and that is kind of a more historical sanctuary where people went into church properties on the understanding that generally speaking, enforcement authorities don't like to barge through church doors because it looks bad and it involves kind of an intrusion into church matters. Now, whether the federal government would have the authority to go into the church and arrest her is a different matter. But as you pointed out, as a matter of policy, even this very aggressive federal government agency has adopted a stance where they're not likely to do that in the ordinary case, especially for someone who's not a dangerous person.
Well, we have to take a short break, but Vikram, if you could stick around, I have one more question. So hopefully we can wrap up this conversation about Francisca Leno, an immigrant in Chicago. She's currently taking sanctuary to Methodist Church there. I'm Brian Mackey. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been talking about Francisca Lino, an immigrant. She's in Chicago. She's taking sanctuary at a Methodist church. We are talking with Dean Vikram Amar of the University of Illinois College of Law. I just wanted to ask you, depending on the outcome of this case, what kinds of broader implication can a lawsuit like this have for immigration enforcement policy and for people who are in the country without legal authorization?
Well, I think a lot depends on the facts that are found by the courts in her case. But if courts end up making bold new law about the kind of due process that is required when people are arrested at the border, that could have the potential for opening up a lot of other arrests over the past few decades that have put people into trouble and jeopardized their immigration status. Of course, any bold legal ruling like that would probably make its way to the Supreme Court. And one thing we've seen, even with the president's executive orders concerning travel, is sometimes the lower courts and the Supreme Court have a very different attitude on these matters.
All right. Thank you for your time. That's Vikram Amar. He's dean of the University of Illinois College of Law. We appreciate you joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. We're about to hear a pretty remarkable story from Illinois history. It's filled with action, adventure, death-defying odds. In all likelihood, it's a story you probably haven't heard before. 50 years ago, Chicago transplant Francis Brenton completed a perilous journey that took him from the shores of Lake Michigan up through the Great Lakes, down the St. Lawrence River, and across the Atlantic Ocean to Senegal on the west coast of Africa, narrowly avoiding catastrophe time and time again. Brenton wasn't the first or last person to complete a daring maritime solo mission, so what made his trip so special? Well, for one, Brenton made his journey in a canoe, not the first thing that comes to mind when you think of seafaring vessels. Chicago Tribune digital news editor Colleen Connolly is on the line to help us remember this often overlooked but captivating part of Illinois history. Also on the line is Ked Fairbank, executive director of the Chicago Maritime Museum. Colleen, Ked, welcome to The 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Colleen, before getting into the details about his 1967 transoceanic canoe voyage, can you please tell us a little bit about Francis Brenton? What do we know about him?
Yeah, so there's actually not a ton known about him outside of the Tribune archives, which is kind of interesting. When you Google his name, not a whole lot comes up. But he was, the best description is to say he was an adventurer. He's from England, but he traveled around the world and fought in World War II in Asia. And then he eventually made his way to Chicago, where he somehow got in the business of selling artifacts to the Field Museum. So on his travels, he would collect little things from tribes, including the canoe that he actually took to Africa. He got that from Colombia, South America.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who sounds like Indiana Jones, right? But British, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, this is an era with Thor Heyerdahl and Kon-Tiki. There's a lot of adventure. Do we know why he decided to one day sail, of all things, a canoe from Diversey Harbor in Chicago to Senegal, thousands of miles away in Africa?
When he was asked why he did what he did, his answer was always along the lines of, you know, just for the heck of it. He enjoyed the adventure. He didn't want to be tied down. He could make a little money by bringing the artifacts back, and he was a total free spirit. Actually, the Tribune reporter who kind of followed him before his journey and then after, he described him as a free spirit whose psyche marches to music that more prosaic humans seldom hear and never heed. So it's quite a description, I'd say.
And he was working for the Field Museum, you said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Ked, as somebody who is very familiar with maritime history tied to the state of Illinois, what can you tell us about Brenton's boat? I got to imagine it's pretty difficult to cross the Atlantic in, you know, your run-of-the-mill canoe you get at the sporting goods store.
No, you couldn't. You couldn't. And it was not a fiberglass boat. It was a dugout canoe. It was bought in Colombia, where they have cashew trees that grow to 100 feet tall, with only about half of them having branches on them. So they're ideal for making dugouts because they don't have knots. Their hull integrity becomes terrific. So you can choose the length you want it, cut it off, and you burn out the center section, scrape it out, and you can make, and they make fishing canoes with those down in Colombia, which is where he bought the first one, about a 26-foot long, I think it was a San Blas deep fishing vessel.
So, I mean, it sounds more like a catamaran, I guess, right? And I gather there's a sail, maybe even a motor on this thing?
Well, in the end, it was. He bought the original one that was for the Field Museum, and then he looked at it and said, how will I get this back to Chicago? So then he bought a second one that was a little shorter, which is the one that the Field Museum still has. We have the original one. We have the original one he bought at the museum in storage. And so he bought the second one. He said, I'll make a catamaran out of this, and I'll sail and motor up. And so he put it together and left Columbia and motored right up through the Caribbean to New Orleans, up the Illinois River, or up the Mississippi, Illinois River, through the locks, and motored to Burnham Harbor and hailed someone, said, go up and tell the museum I've got their catamaran for them here.
So, Colleen, it's 1967. It's the height of the Vietnam War. And here is this Chicago transplant, British guy, we said, embarking on this journey as part of a Field Museum expedition. What route does he take to get from Chicago to Senegal?
It's quite interesting to follow. So he starts in the Lake Michigan and works his way up through the Great Lakes and through a series of canals and smaller lakes that kind of connect them until he gets to Canada, the St. Lawrence River. He takes that route over to Montreal, to Newfoundland, and then that's really when the journey starts, even though quite a bit happened just to get to Newfoundland. But he counts the whole trip starting from Canada. So from there, he goes out into the ocean. His plan was to get to the Azores, kind of off the coast of Portugal there, and then down to Africa. But he gets lost on the way, and he does make it eventually. But it's from there, it's a bit hard to know where he ended up because he himself didn't really know where he was a lot of the time.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is an expedition that has a lot of danger in it, right? I mean, there were a handful of moments along the way where Brenton feared catastrophe. I mean, it occurred to me, how do you pack enough food and water to get a canoe from Chicago to Africa? I mean, can you talk about what some of those moments were like for him?
Exactly, yeah. It wasn't easy, that's for sure. And I imagine a lot of people wouldn't have been able to do what he did. After he left Canada, he said on the 19th day, he encountered a big storm, and in the storm he was okay. His boat was damaged, but he was able to repair it. But in that process, he lost all of his drinking water and his radio and clock, and he didn't use traditional navigational tools otherwise. So without those things, he was pretty much, you know, he didn't really have any way to know where he was going beyond the rising and the setting of the sun and the stars. For food, he didn't lose his food in the storm, at least not all of it, but he ran out later because his journey took more than twice as long as he thought it would. And he got pretty creative. He ran into a couple of boats on his way to Africa, which was lucky. They gave him some food and some water, but not really enough to last his journey. So when he would run out of those provisions, he actually collected rainwater on like a tarp, I'd imagine, on his boat whenever it rained. And for food, he started eating barnacles and moss, plankton, I mean, really anything. He didn't have fishing supplies, so he couldn't even fish, but he managed to eat something.
Yeah, and barnacles, those are little things that stick to the bottom of boats, right? I mean,
yes, he took them off his boat, yep.
Wow, that does not sound very appetizing, I got to say.
not at all.
Colleen, how long does it take him to get to Senegal then?
So it took him from Newfoundland, it took him 106 days, and his original estimate was that it would take about 45 days.
Okay. That is a long time to be on the water. So he gets there safely. Upon hearing of Brenton's safe arrival in Senegal, his friend, Ralph Frace, told the Tribune, quote, "Isn't it wonderful? It isn't often Chicago has this type of adventure." Ked, I wonder, in your opinion, where does Francis Brenton's voyage rank in terms of Illinois history? You know, our state just celebrated its 199th birthday a few days ago. We're gearing up for the bicentennial celebration. Where does this rank?
Yeah, it's up there just because he's a British explorer, among other things, but Chicago was based and founded on the water and adventures, starting with Joliet and Marquette, who came by canoe, discovered Chicago, documented it, doing the portage through the swamps, the old Muddy Lake. And after that, it became the home of the voyageurs, the Frenchmen, who were adventurers who would come by canoe, pick up pelts, and head back up through the Great Lakes and the same portage, the Ottawa River to Montreal, to drop them off. So it follows in a tradition of a city that grew based on adventurers and canoes and the water.
Yeah, I mean, a long history there. You know, let's get back to Brenton's story. He arrives in Senegal. It takes him months and months to get there. He stays until May of the following year. He then sails back to Chicago in the same boat. But Ked, I gather that was not his original plan.
No, his original plan was he had the idea that you could use balloons starting from Senegal, given the trade winds, to essentially tow the canoe across to roughly the West Indies. He had in his canoe, the main canoe was actually covered. This is something Ralph Fries and as he did in the canoe center, covered with the plastic and whatever to try and protect it from water, but it included the balloons and the other things he needed to launch the balloons. So he made a number of attempts in Senegal to get underway with the balloons about 200 feet off the water, towing the canoe. That was the concept. Hopefully using trade winds in about 3 weeks, I think was the estimate, or a month to the West Indies. Never worked though. The balloons escaped and had to be shot down by the Air Force.
And he's paddling the rest of the time, I guess, right? I mean, you know, when he's not using the sail or the motor, you're doing a lot of paddling when you're canoeing across the ocean.
Well, he had sails, so okay. He was able to use the sails, and with the trade winds, essentially a following wind. He was not a great navigator, but eventually, if you sail far enough and long enough, you'll find a piece of land.
Colleen, I wonder what this story, I gather, captured the imagination of people who were reading about him in the Tribune in the 1960s. Why do you think that was?
It's kind of speculation here, but I was wondering when I was researching him why there was a seven-part series, which is a really big series, at least in today's world, seven-part series on this guy, front page every day, yet there wasn't really a whole lot else out there. So, you know, I was asking myself that question, why this resonated, and I think it's just what else was happening in 1967, the Vietnam War. There was a lot of protests against racial inequality and violence. Some of the headlines that appeared alongside this were about, there was one about a Chicago police officer being found as a KKK leader, you know, so very heavy news. And this was a story out of a storybook. And I think it, in a way, was probably a way for people to escape their daily lives and the heavier news of the day as well.
So we've got about a minute here, but Colleen, what happened to Brenton after this historic voyage?
Unfortunately, we don't know a whole lot, because a couple of years after he made it back, he decided to do yet another solo canoe trip across the Atlantic, and this time he was going from Portsmouth, Virginia to Portsmouth, England, ostensibly to visit his family back home. But at some point after he left, he was just never heard from again. So likely he was lost at sea, either that or he somehow escaped and adopted a new identity, which is not likely. So it looks like in the end, the sea won out.
Wow. That's Chicago Tribune digital news editor Colleen Connolly and Chicago Maritime Museum executive director Ked Fairbank. They joined the 21st to discuss adventurer Francis Breton, who 50 years ago completed a solo canoe journey from Lake Michigan to Africa. That's all the time we have for today. You can follow the 21st on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We're produced by Robin Lynn, Alan Montecilio, and Bob Holly. Libby Foster and Grace Stetson are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.